Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. Interesting program for you today. It's still the 75th anniversary year for Batman. And much like I did last year with Superman, I'm going to go back and present some interesting moments over the years on Word Balloon, where we spoke to creators on their moments, great moments that they had writing the Batman and drawing the Batman character. We're going to be talking to Neil Adams, who talks about his work getting started on Brave and Bold and that evolution to his work with Denny O'Neill, and subsequently a lot of his, as I call them, contemporaries in the Bronze Age, using Neil's style of Batman, the way they drew him and the way Batman was written. Then we're going to be talking to Marty Pasco, who talks about his experiences on the Batman animated series. That was a great time in the 90s. It's, of course, a very influential time for a lot of people. Marty was the liaison between Warner Brothers Animation and DC, and was one of the script writers of Batman the Animated Series. In fact, also worked on the great Batman Mask of the Phantasm movie, which, man, I'm telling you, I saw it on the big screen, and it really was an event. And it still looks great on DVD today, but I'll tell you, man, there was nothing like seeing that thing on the big screen. Then we're going to be talking to Jeff Loeb, who will be talking about his work on Hush. Not only what we read, but also a sequel to Hush that unfortunately never got made. And with Jeff's association with Marvel, it's a good question of if it will ever be made. But Jeff spoils a bit of a future possible Batman story involving the Hush storyline. And then we wrap things up with Steve Englehart. Now, Steve is a great Bronze Age Batman creator. He's still an excellent writer today. He's moved on to novels and kind of hints that he doesn't miss comics. And it might be because of his experiences with Batman that unfortunately were pleasant during the days of the Bronze Age with Marshall Rogers, to some of the unpleasant things when they took story pieces from the Laughing Fish story and other Englehart Batman stories and used them in some of the more recent Batman movies. I'll let Steve explain and give his side of the story as we wrap things up on today's Word Balloon. It's all brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you for your support, and I appreciate it. If you go to wordballoon.com and click on the donate tab or subscribe tab, you'll see videos there directing you to the Patreon page, patreon.com/wordballoon. And if you can spare an extra buck or two and help me out, that would be terrific. Word Balloon is free. It will always be free. But if you want to help the cause and help me out when I travel to conventions and upgrade my equipment and keep things going here and provide you the entertainment that I hope you enjoy every week, a way to do that would be to subscribe via Patreon. Word Balloon is also brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Tremendous deals are going on at InStockTrades.com. We're talking about Batman, and for example, you can get the Batman 66 Volume 2 hardcover. Man, Jeff Parker is doing such a great job on that series. So are many other writers, and also, of course, the artists as well. But you can get Volume 2 50% off. It's just $9.99. Or if you want, you can get the trade paperback of Volume 1 of Batman 66 for just $7.49. From Marvel, you can get Volume 1 of the all-new Ultimates, Michelle Fife, Power for Power. Trade paperback Volume 1 is 50% off. It's just $8.99. You can get Marvel Masterworks, Ms. Marvel Volume 1. The hardcover is 50% off, just $34.99. Or you can enjoy G. Willow Wilson's new take on Ms. Marvel. The first trade paperback is available, 50% off, just $7.99. From Dark Horse, Usagi Yojimbo, Stan Sakai's wonderful series, you can get the Saga trade paperback, Volume 1, 50% off. It's just $12.49. From Boom, the Peanuts trade paperback, Volume 4, is 50% off. It's just $6.99. Just in time for the holidays, Archie's Favorite Christmas Comics trade paperback, 50% off, just $4.99. Or how about this, man, from our pals Matt Fraction and Howard Chaykin, Volume 2 of Satellite Sam. Sam and Kinescope is 42% off, $8.69. And I know everyone loves Sex Criminals. I love Sex Criminals, too. But you know this book speaks to me. And as I said in my last interview about Satellite Sam with Matt, it, to me, really reads and feels like a really lush novel. And if you haven't been reading Satellite Sam, I urge you to pick up those two trades. And they make it easy for you at InStockTrades.com. Check out all the great deals. They are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. Okay, this was from the first year of Word Balloon. So, and in fact, both the audio, I'll admit, on this interview, my audio is just a little rough. It's not perfect. You know, I kind of sucked at the beginning and really had trouble recording these conversations. And luckily, the guests are always interesting, and they do the majority of the talking. But you're going to hear Neil Adams talking about his work on Batman and the things he did to evolve the character coming off of the TV series and the, you know, kind of silliness that bled into the comics and for a while helped raise sales. But then sales really started to plummet again. And luckily, creators like Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill came around to dust Batman off and bring him back to his original greatness. And really, you know, there's been no stopping Batman ever since then. So let's listen to Neil Adams talk about his start at DC and eventually finally getting the opportunity to work on Brave and Bold with Bob Haney. Here it is now on Word Balloon.
I kind of played around. I did Elongated Man, and I did the war stuff and Jerry Lewis. Then I did Brave and Bold stuff where I got to play with Batman after being turned down by the Batman editor.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That and thinking back now that you were turned down, and you know, well, at least they did give you Brave and Bold because that's what I first saw as a very small kid.
Yes. Well, in fact, I think if Julius Schwartz could have gotten up from his desk and kicked me out of his office, he would have done when I asked to do Batman. But I didn't think he did it. I mean, I've always got along with Julius Schwartz, the editor of the Batman books. But to be perfectly honest, he was working under a constrained condition where he had to follow the way the license was written, and he could only hire certain people, and he could only do it a certain way. So he just didn't let me do it.
There wasn't room for you because was the work still being split up between Carmine Infantino and the Kane studio of guys like Robinson and?
Well, actually, no. I mean, Robinson had long before left. He actually became a real artist, unlike the rest of us. No, Carmine was no longer doing Batman. He was doing actually Dead Man at that point. I think he was sick of doing Batman.
Okay.
So they were back to the Bob Kane stuff,
okay.
which, to be perfectly honest, just wasn't very good. And much of it followed the old TV show.
Yes.
So besides being, you know, losing Carmine Infantino, following the old TV show was ridiculous because you had Batman walking down the street in the middle of the daytime in his costume and people not commenting that there was a man in his long underwear with a long cape on walking down the street. Mommy, isn't that weird? The kind of thing that really makes the character smaller in the eyes of the reading public. So I had no interest in doing that Batman. I certainly had an interest in doing, you know, the Batman. That's what I wanted to do. So Julie didn't let me do it. So I went over to Brave and Bold, and I asked Murray Boltonoff, who was the editor, who was very mellow and would be pretty much delighted with anything that I would do for him because we just had a great relationship. After all, I was doing Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis for him.
Okay, there you go.
So there you go. I asked if I could work on Brave and Bold, which included Batman as one of the characters in the book. Might as well be a Batman book. And I started to do these stories, and I said, look, I don't want to change the stories. I said, but if I can just do this, Murray, anything that takes place in the daytime, I'd rather have take place at night. And I like to have a little flexibility and, you know, moving panels around to make sure that the story gets told a little bit more adventurously.
Mm-hmm.
So he was fine. No problem. So I started to do Brave and Bold, and after a couple of months, I guess fans started to write letters to Julie Schwartz asking him how come the only Batman at DC Comics was in Brave and Bold.
And you had some, like, resistance from Bob Haney, the writer of Brave and Bold, didn't you? Because
I was aware of.
Oh, okay.
We got along great.
Because clearly not only did you redesign Batman, but even things like Green Arrow.
Well, Bob Haney was you have to remember that even though I'm known for working with Denny O'Neill, if you look at those Brave and Bold stories, you will see an abundance of story in each one of those. Very, very full and thick storytelling and good stories.
Absolutely.
So it was a pleasure to be working on those stories, and my relationship with Bob Haney was quite terrific. I didn't change anything. In fact, it was sort of Bob Haney's idea to update and revamp Green Arrow. He didn't quite know what to do with it. He said, you know, he ought to be, you know, we're going to present him again. Let's revamp him a little bit. But he didn't quite know what I had in mind. I didn't know I had in mind to turn him into rather more of an Errol Flynn type of Robin Hood. But as far as he was concerned, that was just great. We had a, you know, there were, I actually never had a bad word with Bob Haney in my whole time with him.
I appreciate the correction because, yeah, it didn't make sense to me because I thought I had read that there was a problem and that you were even taken off of Brave and Bold, but that didn't make sense because you had subsequent issues.
No, I think that in fact, if they could have kept me on Brave and Bold for as long as they could, they probably would have done it. I think Bob Brown continued after I did, but what happened was that Julie Schwartz attacked me in the hallway and insisted that I was destroying Batman. But since I was destroying it, I ought to do it in the Batman comic book rather than Brave and Bold. So he purloined me from Brave and Bold to do Batman in the Batman comic books.
And you and Denny O'Neill just hit the ground running.
It was kind of a surprise that that worked out so well. But Denny had been a reporter previously, so his grounding was a little less fanciful than you might find in a regular comic book writer. And because of that, his stories tended to be a little grittier and tended to be less, it's the Riddler hopping around telling riddles.
Sure.
Even when we agreed that we would bring the Joker back, the Joker was a rather deadly character and would laugh and tell jokes, but usually blow people up while he did it. So Denny's contribution was to, thankfully, from my point of view, to include the grittiness that I had begun in Brave and Bold, but to also do that to the story. So it was very cool.
Certainly there were contemporaries as well that seemed to take your style and use it as a starting point.
Well, I don't know if they were contemporary. I think that they were later. The thing about Neil's contemporaries, if we can speak about them
please,
for a moment, is there aren't any.
I can appreciate that, certainly.
At the time that I got into comic books, nobody was getting into comic books. In fact, I don't know of anybody outside of perhaps Jim Steranko, who was a magician.
Right.
For a long time. who actually got into comic books at the time that I did, or that is anywhere within my age, 5 years on either side.
Yeah, I was thinking of Aparo.
Aparo, I believe, is quite a bit older.
Okay, yeah.
But he worked for Charlton for quite a long time. I don't know. I would have to check into it. That's the first time that was mentioned. Now you pique my curiosity.
Okay, no,
I would only because Jim died.
Right.
Maybe that's incorrect for me to think that he was quite a bit older.
No, and he was, and you're right. He did do the Charlton work as well. It just seemed that once your Batman, for example, was established, that was the look for Batman, and maybe guys weren't drawing as much like you before then. But
yeah.
Certainly, your Batman was the template of the 70s.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, Vic.
What do you mean of the 70s? Hold on. Up until now, I think until that movie, the movie that just came out.
That's true.
Don't you think?
Yeah. No, I understand.
It's back and forth with Batman, but pretty much that's the Batman that we know and love. I mean,
well, the group of contemporaries I was thinking of was in that 70s decade. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, no, and I know, and I would call them copiers.
Well, yeah. was that editorially driven?
All I'm saying is that they recognized what it was that I was doing. They realized that if they did that, they could make a living more easily, and so they did it, and they liked it. And they were, all those guys were fans of mine.
Sure.
And very, very positive fans. I think the ones, though, that you have to recognize a little bit more are people who did what I did and then took it one step further. That, in other words, did their version of my version.
No, I understand what you mean.
And those people didn't necessarily do it in my style, but they did my Batman in their style. Whereas Jim Aparo and Irv Novik basically just did my Batman.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
All of which is all very complimentary and wonderful, either way you go. But right then, when that happened, since I couldn't be five people, then DC was quite happy to have three or four other people that could
capture that
a reasonable range be Neil as well as Neil was.
And again, yeah, I was wondering, was that editorially driven or was it the artist saying, hey, this is working, let's all...
I think it was sort of like the tide, it pretty much was there.
Okay.
I don't think anybody drew back from it, I think everybody's really relieved to get out of that.
Yeah.
The show was great. I tell you, I love that show. But it was epitomized by, as I understand, in my mind, by I think it was Jill St. John who was on top of this cyclotron that managed to sit on a sound stage, and somehow she fell into the, quote, cyclotron, which you got the feeling that you could move if you gave it a shove across the stage. And Batman said, "Oh, what a way to go-go." And I thought, well, I mean, that sort of that says what that show is.
Right, it's a farce.
It's a farce.
Yeah.
It's a satire. And sufficiently fun and wonderful for the time, but if you're reading Batman comic books, that's not what you want to see.
No, and in fact, the show itself was short-lived in terms of its popularity as well, and only made it to, like, the 2.5 seasons or something.
Well,
like that.
Although it was tremendously popular. Nobody really missed that show the first 2 years. Maybe the third year, people got a little bit tired of it because you could do so many costumed idiots. I mean, once you got...
Vincent Price.
Who's that big guy who played the Pharaoh in the...
Oh, King Tut, Victor Bruno.
After a while, you know, it got to be a little bit...
Too much, man.
Here's Neil making fun of that character while, you know, at the same time, there's the Penguin and the Joker and all the rest of it. It was all pretty silly.
Next up, we talk to Marty Pascoe. Marty is just this invaluable source of information, and Word Balloon listeners know this. You just say, "How you doing, Marty?" And he just goes and really has this incredible memory and, I think, a very vivid way of describing how things worked. Both at DC Comics and then also his time at Warner Animation working on the Batman animated series and also Mask of the Phantasm. And here's a great hunk of Marty Pascoe just going on about his work on Batman. So I hope you'll enjoy it now on Word Balloon.
I wanted to ask about your involvement with the Batman animated series because I really think that it represents, you know, the definitive Batman in a way that a lot of films couldn't achieve, a lot of other television series couldn't achieve, and I think, you know, it's a hallmark in the various incarnations of Batman, including the film, and I know you were one of the four writers on the film. I mean, that really, I would say, up until Chris Nolan's movie 2 years ago, to me, that was the best Batman film, quite frankly.
Well, thank you very much. At the risk of sounding immodest, I can tell you that I think all four of us thought that, too. You know, including the thing about Chris Nolan, you know.
Yeah.
We had thought that we got as close as anyone had come to nailing the essentials of that character. Ironically enough, it was my experience that animation, the fact that it was in animation rather than live action, was the thing that made it work. I've had this theory for a long time that costume superheroes specifically have a much harder hill to climb, I guess, in translating into live-action film. And that the stylization that animation affords you is often more suited to the material.
Sure.
There's less of a disconnect between form and content.
While we're taping this, last night Smallville aired their Justice League episode, and I don't know if you had a chance to see it.
There was a Justice League episode of Smallville?
Well, they approximated all the different characters, the other superhero characters that they have introduced in the last couple of years. This year, very heavily, they're relying on Green Arrow. But they had Aquaman, Green Arrow, The Flash, Cyborg from the Titans, and Clark all working together against Lex Luthor. And as you said,
for the Cyborg episode was one of the last things I read before I left DC.
Okay.
And I haven't really been keeping up with the show, so I didn't know there was a Green Arrow.
It's interesting because, as you say, live-action costume people just doesn't work. And as opposed to having a full mask and cowl like the Batman characters and then other characters and stuff, a lot of them would have kind of, you know, almost like hoodies, like hooded sweatshirts and everything.
Right.
And it's that kind of look that replaced, I think, the full-on costume look.
I think, just speaking for myself, that my comfort level with the idea of the animation made it easier for me to think in terms that I would not necessarily have thought in before. The experience of the show was a very interesting one. I had been working at Disney Comics, and I had been maintaining a close friendship with a guy I had worked with in production at other studios, who had gone into the programming side and was now the second lieutenant to Margaret Lesh at Fox Children's. And And he was asking, what was I doing? And I wasn't particularly busy at the time. And he started talking up this Warner Brothers show that they had, Beetlejuice. And all of that left me rather cold. It was one of those things where the impossible challenge of adapting it for Saturday morning television. This was a character who was a demon from hell, and you weren't allowed to use the words demon or hell. So, in fact, they had to turn the nether world into the neither world. N-E-I-T-H-E-R. Neither hell, nor heaven, nor anything your parents would disapprove of. And I said, no thanks. I'll tell you, Sidney, the show I'm really interested in working on, I said, is Batman. And he went, oh, really? Oh, yeah, well, we're having some trouble there. And this was before Alan Burnett had been brought in as the supervising producer.
I see.
And so the next thing I know, I'm getting a call from Sidney. He said, Alan wants to meet you. So I go over to Hanna-Barbera, where he's still toiling on a Scooby-Doo project, and we sit and we talk. And he hires me as a story editor. First of all, he gives me a writing assignment. And he's having trouble getting it past Bruce. So that should have told me something.
Wow. Was this for the Clayface episodes, Feet of Clay?
No. It was an early a Mad Hatter episode.
Okay.
And Alan was much more familiar with D.C., and much more familiar with the politics of dealing with D.C. than Bruce had been, since Alan had done a number of years on the Super Friends show at HB
okay.
in the late 70s and early 80s. So my direction from him was to follow some recognizable version of the backstory of the character, and using the hats and crimes and that sort of thing. And Bruce just ultimately wanted a different take on the character, and until... I think it was Joe Lansdale who came up with the whole, I forget what the show was called, but the show that introduced the Hatter character.
Okay.
Until that came along, he didn't find it. But in the meantime, just in seeing how I rewrote and how I responded to the notes and what I understood about the character, Alan said, forget the script. I need a story editor.
Cool.
So he hired me.
Okay.
And at that point, it was just Laren Bright and Sean Derrick, who had story edited the episodes that they had been able to produce at this point.
Was this still part of the first season?
Some of them were, yeah. Mm-hmm. But what happened is that show was in production for about a year without a real story editor.
Okay.
And they kept falling further and further behind. It was in production for a year without being scheduled. And the problem was, they kept submitting scripts that DC would reject. And I was kind of surprised to see that DC had that kind of power. But apparently, in the beginning, Denny O'Neill himself was reading all the scripts.
Wow.
And they showed me a very large box filled with scripts that had been written off. And some of them had titles like Rockabye Batman. Need I say more?
Yeah, harkening back to the 60s, Zab Pow, yeah.
And then Alan said, you know, we got three shows into production in a matter of like a week or two. And Alan said, this is good, but even going at this pace, we're never going to make up the time. We're stuck here. We need another story editor. Alan had managed to break down the various log jams that had been holding up production. So now everyone was working at full capacity, and it still wasn't enough. So Alan said to me, do you know some story editor who, you know, might be good for the show? And I said, Michael Reeve, sure. Michael and I were old friends, and we'd worked in a lot of situations together. And so Michael Reeves came aboard. At this point, Paul Dini, who was on staff as a writer and story editor, was still working on one of the Spielberg things, whether it was...
Animaniacs and all that?
Animaniacs or... You know,
Pinky and the Brain.
The Wackadoo Twins. I don't know. I didn't see another one of those things. And was busy with that, but they were winding up production. And then Paul came over to Batman once he was done with that show. And basically, everybody worked in a slightly different style. Michael was good at finding really exceptional writers who had either some experience in live-action television, but were primarily literary, or had maybe done one or two cartoons. But most of the people that Michael brought in were from outside the usual talent pool.
Okay.
And he brought in Joe Lansdale,
mm-hmm.
he'd run in his old friends, Garn, Judith Reeve Stevens, et cetera, et cetera. And Michael wrote a few episodes. I was less inclined to do so because I was used to the world of Live, where what you make on a script is over and above your salary.
Okay.
But Warner Bros. At that time had a policy where your script fee was a draw against salary. So on that basis, I declined to write a script. I relaxed that a little bit toward the end and did one episode. But I was there because I was the rewrite guy more than they, you know. If something came in and it was a page one rewrite, or just a total mess, or just went off on some sort of tangent from the outline, they'd hand it to me. And there are some of the stories of episodes. You know, I don't jump. I never jump credits. I realize, of course, in animation, you almost have to get ahead, and nobody resents it because there's no money attached to it. But in Live, everybody whose name actually goes on screen gets a residual. So it's generally considered among the gentlemen in television that if you jump credit on a freelancer, outside writer's script, after you rewrite it, you're picking his pocket. So for me, that was always a no-no, and I never did that.
Okay.
So there are a lot of the shows that I story edited, there's maybe one or two lines of dialogue from the credited writer left.
Wow.
And a lot, and that's not, I don't want that to be interpreted as being arrogant or necessarily even a condemnation of those writers. What happens is sometimes you're responding to editorial, network concerns, you're mm-hmm. responding to standards and practices concerns, you get notes from all of the producers, and somebody has an idea to take the thing in a different direction, and if you've already bought a draft and a polish from that outside writer, even though there's no rule against it in animation to bring in that writer and expect him to do more rewriting for his original fee, all of us on the show were reluctant to do that. And it was more of a practical consideration than anything else because we knew that these people had moved on to their next job and wouldn't be really available necessarily to drop whatever they were doing and come rewrite this thing that they turned in a month ago.
Okay.
So that's my goal. My main thing there was I was the problem solver. And good for dialogue polishes if the voice that was cast for the role didn't really sound, you could imagine it wouldn't sound right with that dialogue. Sometimes that was done in recording sessions. You'd rewrite things. And Paul pretty much wrote his own stuff. And so functioned as a staff writer in the beginning. He brought in a couple of writers, but there was never a motivation, apparently, for much repeat business. I think it was only two or three cases of Paul story editing other writers. And Alan supervised the whole thing, occasionally wrote stories. He wrote one episode or two himself. But that's basically the way the series worked.
Hmm.
The way the movie worked was Alan, originally as part of his deal, Alan was going to write the feature. But he was so busy, and the show was so successful, that the order was expanded. So I mean, he was in over his head, but they still wanted to do the movie. So he wrote an outline, and all four of us wrote different sections of the script. Alan wrote the first 20 pages or so. I did all of the flashback stuff, the graveyard scenes, his memories of just becoming Batman, designing the costume, etc. I
mm-hmm.
did all of that stuff. Michael Reeves did the third act, not really an act, it's the third section. And then the climax where the Joker shows up, that was all Paul Dini, because Paul had this kind of Gibbs on the Joker thing. no biggie. I was never that fond of the model for that character anyway.
Okay.
That's just because I've got Dick Sprang's version stuck in my head.
I understand. Yeah, that was and it was fun to see in the series that Legends of the Dark Knight episode where they had a section that did very much look like Dick Sprang art. It was the three kids talking about what they've heard about the Legends of Batman.
That sounds like it was inspired by a very short Batman story that was one of Levitz's favorites. And he's always asking me to send copies of it to people working on Batman-related media material. I think the story is called The Batman Nobody Knows. But it's Bruce Wayne around a campfire with a bunch of kids. And they're all telling him different stories of what they've heard about the Batman. They've never met him, they've never seen him. And they all have these very fanciful notions of what Batman is like.
Was the film based on things like, was it Batman Year 2 or whatever, where we had like the Reaper or something story from the 80s? the Phantasm, the character of the Phantasm seemed to be taken from the comic books. And it was, to say the Mike Barb, okay, you tell me, yeah, what was the inspiration for that?
Alan just wanted a very fearsome character. See, the thing is, even though we knew it was going to be at the very least a direct-to-video film or a theatrical, of course, that was put on the table much later in the process, we still wrote it following Saturday morning rules, more or less. Certain language restrictions were relaxed, referring to killing and referring to murder. We were allowed to do that, but obviously there was no blood. And generally speaking, when you approach something with Saturday morning rules, the model designer's hand freezes up, because there's always that fear that the network is going to, or rather standards and practices, is going to come back to you and say, too frightening for small children, tone it down.
Sure.
But they have to find the middle ground between, you know, rolling over completely so that you have no place to go to, and overplaying your hand by turning in something that is really frightening.
Well, you guys...
So Alan just talked in terms of a villain that had certain things. He wanted a scythe. That's the only thing he really knew.
Okay.
He wanted a mask and he wanted a scythe.
Okay.
And they didn't even have the name for the character until the outline was finished. You know, it was... I think it was called the Reaper character,
okay.
Small R,
mm-hmm.
You know, and then they came up, I don't know where they got Phantasm from, and of course I was always the guy who was asked to open his mouth about certain things and then scowled at when I delivered the information that they didn't want to hear, which was to point out that DC already had a character called Phantasm. I thought it was DC.
Oh.
Somebody had a character named Phantasm. And, you know, so they were always scowling at me because, you know, it was the... Oh, God, we have to call Barbara now and have her call DC, and we may have to make a special deal for the rights clearance, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. But, of course, DC was very cooperative, so, you know, there wasn't anything like that, but they wanted to be very respectful, and they were good at that. He plotted the story, and all the other details were sort of filled in the execution of the script. I don't think that Alan imagined a role for the Joker being as extensive as it was in the finished film, but, of course, when you're giving it to Paul... love for that character, and that stuff is quite clever. So,
yeah,
I mean it worked very, very well.
Oh, absolutely.
But I was always, that was the best cartoon writing experience I ever had. That show.
That's really wow. That's saying something, because G.I. Joe and all the other cartoons that you'd been involved with in the past.
Having an acting background, in the sense that, you know, I studied it. I've done a lot of non-professional work, Equity Waiver, that sort of thing. I've always been acutely frustrated by when a cartoon is being done in a, well, I'm going to put this in quotes so it's not taken too literally, reality-based style, whether it's things like Will Munio's designs, I think for G.I. Joe, I believe he was one of the designers on that show, but that whole style that was very much in vogue in the mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
of naturalistic rendering, which
yes.
is just basically comic book rendering cleaned up a little bit for the animation process,
okay.
which was still really tough to animate in limited animation terms. Whenever any of those characters did a three-quarter turn, the perspective would all go wonky. Getting those highly detailed in rendering figures to act fluidly was extraordinarily difficult. But since that was clearly the attempt, why they would then bring in voice talent and voice directors who would record a Looney Tunes episode. I never understood that. And I literally got, in the beginning on that, and I got some insight into that. When we did the Riddler, the first Riddler show, which was, I story edited that, we were envisioning the Riddler, we wanted to get as far away from the giggling insanity of Frank Gorshin as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was say, let's think of him as George Sanders. Completely cold, arid, intellectual, snob, you know.
Sure.
And we couldn't go into the coldness too much because if that was taken literally, you know, we were then reduplicating Mr. Freeze. But we wanted this very unruffled and not at all manic personality. And John Glover, who voiced the character so nicely, came in And in the first cold reading, I was getting chills because it was spot on. He read the script. He understood what we were going for. And he delivered it beautifully. And then the voice director said, it needs to be bigger, more energy. And John looked a little startled. And then he eventually, after a couple of read-throughs before they started the recording, he settled a match. High and low rolling character that he gave, you know, an over-emphatic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was happy, and I just sort of, you know, sat there biting my lip. But that was a rare exception where somebody had came in with something and they had nailed it, and then in our opinion or my opinion, they were moved away from it. But the reason it was the most satisfying experience was not only because of how beautiful it looked and how well that style animated, why Bruce Timm is one of the most brilliant model designers in the business, but the level of writing that Fox allowed us to do, with not without its battles with standards and practices, of course, but no one on the network side ever said, no, this is too sophisticated for your audience. And that was kind of, at least not in my hearing, which I thought was kind of amazing. It was the fact that the voice talent were not top 40 announcers. The voice talent were not people who would leave the studio and then go do an infomercial.
Yeah.
You know, the then contemporary equivalent of Ryan Seacrest did not do these voices.
No, you had great real actors and really good character actors providing great voices. Yeah, is it Andrea Romano?
Andrea Romano. Andrea Romano at the time was the director of the Warner Brothers voice department, and her boyfriend was a guy named Gordon Hunt, I believe, who was a longtime voice director at Hanna-Barbera. But Gordon was one of these people with a much broader frame of reference. One of his, I don't want to say hobbies, because I'm sure it was a job, but one of the things that he did in when his schedule permitted it was direct the L.A. Chamber Theater repertory group. This was a group of established actors, many of whom ended up in Batman, and who did dramatic readings of classics.
Okay.
And these were recorded and aired on KCRW, the Los Angeles public radio station.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it appealed primarily to, you know, people who mourn the loss of radio acting. And they were just, I mean, it was wonderful. They had magnificent people in them. Stacey Keach, Ed Asner, Rene Auberjonois, a whole group of people that who knew how to act to the microphone, which is the rare thing. And why you don't really hear it in cartoons. When the last of the great old-time radio actors died out, there was nobody left who knew how to act with their voice. And the few who were still around were still working. I mean, Commissioner Gordon was Bob Hastings,
yes,
who was Archie Andrews on the radio in the 40s.
Yep.
But once those people were all busy, it was really hard to find them. But Most of those guys were clients of Joseph Helton and Ricks, which was at the time at least the leading voiceover talent agency. And Andrea has contacts with the community in general were very large, but she also had access to a talent pool beyond that. And it was helped by Gordon's personal relationship with those people. So we got to the point where it was almost like a game. We would suggest voices, and they... The voice people at Warner's, started with these double takes, and they got over that very quickly. Because, we also had another tool at our disposal, which was that we paid well above scale.
Okay. Well, that helps.
A buyout for several episodes. So we attracted a lot of people. I mean, you know, it wasn't a great deal of money, but, you know, if you can get in your car without changing your clothes.
Right.
You know, I mean, we didn't quite have somebody show up in their bathrobe, but close. And, and so we at one point, we suggested, and they said, we have to cast Leslie Tompkins.
Okay.
And I said, Diana Muldaur. And I said, who? And I, because this was This was a while after her last high-profile thing, which was falling down the elevator shaft.
Right in L.A. Law.
Yes.
I forgot about that. Very good.
And so they went, okay. And then they would call back a few days later with another strange tone in their voice. They took it. Well, that's good, isn't it? And it was almost as if you could hear their heads expanding. I got as far as I dug up one name that was a man who's an absolutely brilliant actor who had done one of the chamber reading things for Gordon. When we were doing the Crime Doctor show, I suggested Harris Yulin, and that was like the straw.
Okay.
You know, and Andrea, who came back to me later, said, "Harris Yulin, forget about it." And I won't go into any more specifics, but apparently there was a compelling reason for them to believe that he would not accept the gig. And we were turned down on a couple of occasions. Leonard Nimoy didn't want to do Mr. Freeze, for example. But
well, that's too bad.
Again, that was it. We had acting.
Yeah,
we had acting, so you could feel free to write a subtle line and know it would be delivered.
And interesting people.
So much for tourists.
Well, yeah, but you wouldn't think of, you know, some of these people like, wasn't Harvey Dent, wasn't it Bull from Night Court? Or no, who played Harvey Dent?
Maul.
Yeah, Richard Maul.
Richard Maul.
Yeah, Richard Maul. I mean, that's the thing. Or even in the Superman series, Clancy Brown playing Lex Luthor, a guy that usually is cast because of his look, like a Richard Maul, and you suddenly realize that there's a very powerful voice along with that giant imposing figure as well. And these guys played against type as far as whatever live-action roles they would get, and would bring in these very subtle, nuanced performances in these great character roles. And no, I give Andrea and you guys credit for, you know, recognizing that and giving them the right dialogue and for them executing it. Pretty cool.
It was unlike anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, I had worked throughout the 80s for a studio that was very much cut in the Hanna-Barbera mold, and their voice talent were almost exclusively top four local,
DJs.
LA DJs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and nothing against, you know, guys like Gary Owens and stuff, you know, Space Ghost and, you know, and his, you know, the generations that followed him and everything. But no, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think with the restrictions you guys had in terms of what you could do to show conflict, it's important to have some, you know, kernel of real acting and just whatever ways you could get beyond what standards and practices wouldn't allow you to do. So, you know, you guys achieved a very timeless animation series that, you know, lives on and does very well in DVD sales because of the strength of these performances.
Well, we got to the point, too, where we were hearing, you know, there's a 15-minute break usually during the recording sessions. And, you know, actors who may have worked together before elsewhere, hadn't seen each other in a while, which would schmooze. And we would sort of drift, those of us on the writing staff, on producing staff, if we hadn't already been introduced to them, we would sort of drift about overhearing things deliberately. And the most gratifying moment was hearing one actress, I don't remember who they were, but one said to the other, "I can't believe this script." And the other one chuckled, thinking it was, you know, the guy was about to slam the script. And he said, "No, really. I've worked on live episodic television where the scripts weren't this good. This is a cartoon, and that will remain in my memory for a long time."
That's cool. That's cool. Well, I hope it's interesting now that with Legion of Superheroes and Teen Titans, it seems like they have slightly adjusted their script writing and even the new Batman series. There's something lacking there, and maybe it's because it's not you guys and everything doing it, but it almost seems like it is a notch below. I hate to say it. I mean,
you have the problem now, in that it's not a very competitive market for cartoons. I mean, the overwhelming majority of programming is controlled by Nickelodeon, with Disney and or Cartoon Network in second place.
Sure,
and the cost structure has been at pains to reduce itself dramatically. And so we're not seeing the kind of investment spending anymore that would allow you to go out and get certain kinds of talents or go out and buy rights to material to adapt. And because the paychecks, the paydays in animation are not all that much better today than they were 20 years ago, you're still seeing the phenomenon of the best work coming from people who are just breaking in and move on as quickly as they possibly can.
I understand.
The story editor of the first two seasons, two or three seasons of Teen Titans, is a guy named David Flack, who's a really talented guy. You know, his artfulness in executing changes necessitated by, like, for example, DC's branding concerns, his cleverness and the ways in which you could noticeably see the script improve through rewrites was quite remarkable. And last I heard, David was well out of animation and is now working in episodic, live episodic.
Sure.
And so that goes on. So you're still dependent upon that find, you know, in the case of the latter Superman and Batman stuff, Hilary Bardot. Was it Bardot?
The artist?
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, I was going to say, I don't know.
Artist. Yeah, Hilary Bader was the big find, and she did some rather good work.
Next up, I talked to Jeff Loeb, and this is a fun Loeb report where I took questions from listeners, and they asked some very interesting questions, and you know, it gave me the opportunity to really focus on a couple of Jeff's storylines in particular. We talk about Hush here, of course. Hush was a huge seller for DC Comics. Jim Lee and Jeff doing this amazing 12-part story, and Jeff gives us a lot of behind-the-scenes information on Batman Hush, but also a bit about what would have followed in a sequel that, unfortunately, Jeff's association with Marvel probably makes it pretty unlikely that this will happen. But we get a glimpse of what could have been with Jeff and Jim Lee continuing the Hush storyline. So here's Jeff Loeb answering questions, and also a little bit about comic book movies that I think is an interesting comment and a very fair observation of what looks good on paper and unfortunately doesn't translate well onto the screen when it finally comes about. Here's Jeff Loeb from the Loeb Report, now on Word Balloon.
I love Batman Hush, as did many, and was curious as to the background of the book. Was Tommy Gallagher always meant to be the enigmatic antagonist? Was Jason Todd, but editorial decided differently? Was the book written with Todd's resurrection in mind? And how much of Identity and Infinite Crisis factored into writing it? Lots of questions there about Hush.
All of which have the same answer. If you look at the original proposal, it is exactly... first of all, no one thought we were ever going to be able to do the story. That Jim was never going to be able to draw 12 consecutive issues. No one. Not including Jim, I don't think. And so, you know, the first issue took him some ridiculous number of months in order to write. You know, once he got picked up speed, and you know, it's a fairly infamous story where we had to have... I think it was six issues, no later than, and then Valentine's Day. And this was now like October or something. And we'd been working since, I think, probably the previous Valentine's Day.
Okay.
And I remember that Jim bet Mike Carlin $1,000 that he would have the issues done.
I remember that, actually, yes.
If you actually look in the Superman in 612, when Bruce is looking over Lois's cubicle and Clark is peering over from the other side, there's a piece of paper stuck to the wall that says, Carlin owes me $1,000. And even after we had done that, they weren't sure whether or not it was all going to be just a big miniseries, or it was something that we were going to actually get to be Batman 608. And we still had to sort of... So by the time the first issue hit the stands, we were in the middle of issue 9. So Jason Todd had been resurrected at that point.
Okay.
The story always was the way it was. It's interesting that he remembers him as Tommy Gallagher. His name is Thomas Elliott.
I did that. That's my fault.
Okay, well, you know, you have to stop drinking in the afternoon, young man, especially when you're going to be on the radio. stories to be told. His last name is Elliot because of Elliot Mangan.
Oh, that's cool. Very cool.
And his name is Thomas because of Thomas Wayne. And that was the only stipulation that was made from the very beginning, which was that Paul wanted us to do a 12-part story, wanted me and Jim to work together, all of which we were very happy to do, but he wanted to have a character that we could put into the toy box if we were going to take all the characters out of the toy box. And, you know, for good or for bad, and we can sit here until tomorrow morning and talk about whether or not, you know, Ventriloquist or Zads or, you know, pick the character, has actually stuck. In the world that I live in, there's Ra's al Ghul, and there's maybe Bane, and maybe Killer Croc. But for the most part, we're still running around with the Joker and Two-Face and a lot of guys that were created in the 1940s.
Right.
And so the idea was to try to come up with a character that would be an ongoing menace. And that people would use and see where they were going. And, you know, there's been a little success with it. My hope is to go back someday and do what was always planned as Hush 2. You know, people that have heard that story think it's pretty great. Jim certainly has a great excitement about it. But that's not happening anytime soon.
And quickly, Jason's redesign of the Robin costume that Jason wore, was that all Jim? Did you have input on that? Or
it was the coolest thing ever. Yeah,
yeah, it really was.
The funny part about it, and Joe Quesada asks me all the time whether or not it was originally supposed to be Jason. The truth is, you know, nobody liked Jason. they thought it was the worst idea in the world that we were going to bring him back. And if I had said at the beginning of that story that we were going to bring him back, the outpouring of love that I would have felt would have been at best minimal. It was certainly my feeling that it was a character that was being forgotten, and I often will take a stand the same way I've always taken a stand with Gwen. That, you know, I never intended for Jason to come back. I sort of thought dead is dead. But I did. It was my decision, not editorial's, to leave his body missing. I don't know that I would have chosen to resolve it the way that it was resolved. But, you know, again, that's one of those things that the guy asked before.
Sure.
I don't have any control over. I don't own Jason Todd. I thought that Jeff Johns had a really, really cool way of explaining how Jason was running around the DCU, and that's not the story they chose to tell. So you just don't know when that stuff's going to happen. But I can tell you that when I wrote, you know, the lightning strikes and the coat falls open and the bandages are off, and there stands Jason Todd, I had some idea as to what he was going to do. I think I probably suggested that he was wearing some kind of black leather, but Jim drew it, and I looked at it, and the moment I looked at it, I was like, damn, that looks cool as hell.
Yeah.
I wish there was a way that we could bring this guy back. But again, I think maybe I'd have to go and check my records. I don't think the first issue had actually shipped when he had drawn that picture.
Okay.
And so who knew? I mean, for all we knew, by the time we got the third issue, people would be burning the comic, and that'd be the end of it.
I love the design. I wish that he would wear that rather than the Red Hood look that he currently has. But regardless, I do like what he represents to Batman, which to me always says it's a personal failure that Jason is the way he is now. And that it is someone that, you know, in the back of Bruce's mind is always someone that I screwed up with him.
My pitch on the original All-Star Batman and Robin, which was a book that I was writing when I left for Marvel and then got replaced by Frank Miller. And if you got to get replaced by somebody, it's not a bad choice. But that was going to be Jim and my return to the character. And my original pitch, because at the beginning, we didn't really understand what All-Star was. It was the first time it was going to be, it was pitched, it was take these characters as though it's 1968. That's the continuity that you're using.
I'm with
and
you.
I was
okay.
Like, so basically what you're saying is that Barbara Gordon hasn't been shot. Is there, I mean, is there anything different? Because I really thought that it all should have been year one and just take it from there. And then that way you could do whatever you wanted to do.
Sure.
But and then I didn't know how much you could change stuff around. I never had any idea that they were going to change things as much as they were. Like, you know, the Black Canary is playing such an important role in Batman's world. And, you know, that stuff's fine. It's cool.
Sure.
But the story that I wanted to tell was that that Jason was the first Robin and that he'd been killed. And that Batman then sort of swore that he would never do anything about it, hid the fact that Jason had died, and then met Dick in the same way that he always met Dick, and decided that there was a way that all the mistakes that he had made with Jason he could rectify with Dick, which is a little bit more like what he did with Tim Drake, having failed with Jason. But what I liked about the story was that the only two people that knew what he had done were Gordon and Superman, both of whom came to Bruce and said, what the hell are you doing? Like, you've already gotten one child killed. Why would you do this again? And that it, you really saw sort of Batman's arrogance about it, that he thought that he could make up for the death of his child by making it right with another child.
Right.
But that was not a story that ever got told.
That's cool. I'm always curious about the stories that don't get told, so that's, I appreciate that. Thank you. Sith asks, there's been some fan speculation that the whole Red Hulk thing is to coincide with the upcoming Hulk movie. What are your thoughts on comics in general matching up with the movie properties?
Well, that's two different questions. One, the Hulk thing has nothing to do with the movie.
Okay.
However, you know, me, I'm no fool. the truth is that I knew that both Hulk and Iron Man are going to get a lot more heat on them because of the movie.
Sure.
So the idea of doing a new Hulk book when there's a big Hulk movie coming out is a great idea. You know, but I just want to remind everyone that it was my big idea to do a Catwoman miniseries with the one person who I thought could not fail doing a Catwoman miniseries. And I was Tim Sale, that would coincide with this incredibly great Catwoman movie that was coming out starring Halle Berry. And we had less than stellar results in all regards. And it happens to be one of my favorite things that we've ever done. But, you know, to this day, DC insists that the movie hurt the comic.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Now, I don't know that. I think it has more to do with the fact that it is very, very hard to launch a female-driven story, I would say Wonder Woman being the sole exception, into the marketplace. It's just hard to do.
I can appreciate that, but isn't there a difference specifically with the Catwoman story in the Halle Berry film because of the existence of the Selina Kyle character in the, you know, Michael Uslane Batman production, you know, the films now and the films back in the 80s and 90s, and that the character was established, so they had to use a different version of Catwoman for that Catwoman film? Because that's what I think turned, I mean, that was the first mistake among many as far as what was wrong with that movie, I thought.
I don't know. I wasn't there in order to answer that question. You know, there's always this big hoo-ha that Hollywood changes the comics and that's what ruins them, and I do think that it is curious that when the stories deviate from the canon that those movies tend to fail.
Yeah.
More often than not, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the more you get it right, the more it works, and I think a lot of that has to do with, one, that your fan base is extremely vocal and absolutely can kill a movie by going out the first weekend and then telling everybody it's the worst thing ever. So there's that side of it. And then there's the other side of it, which is it doesn't matter whether or not it's, you know, your fan base likes it or doesn't like it. A bad movie is a bad movie is a bad movie.
Right.
And that'll kill anything. You know, I'm sure that all the Alvin and the Chipmunk fans are absolutely delighted that there's a $200 million Alvin and Chipmunk movie. You couldn't have guessed that in a billion years. You know, I'm still surprised that like people went to go see the Garfield movie, and I'm sure there's people who are listening to this right now going, what are you talking about? It's the funniest movie ever.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But I do think that there is something that needs to be respected about a character that has been around for 50 years.
Yeah.
And when you get around this to, like, Superman and Batman, you know, 1940 to now, I mean, we're now coming up 70 years.
Yeah.
So you can tell me till tomorrow morning that, you know, that Superman comes from a planet that still exists and, you know, that everybody runs around in Kryptonian war suits. And I'm going to look at you and go, no, it doesn't. That's not how it works.
Right.
You know, these are stories that one way or another more people know than don't know. And it's very much the path of the story of Cinderella. You know, we all know the story of Cinderella. I can't tell you why I know the story of Cinderella. It's probably because it was told to me. But what I know is that she wanted to go to the ball and that she got to go because of her fairy godmother. She had to be home by midnight. She dropped her glass slipper and the prince found her at the end of the story. That's what I remember. And there's some stepsisters and stepmoms that are pretty evil. In the Superman story, I know that he's actually Clark Kent, that he's in love with Lois Lane, he works for the Daily Planet, and that he's faster than a speeding bullet. The idea that Clark and Lex were friends when they were kids, which is the whole centerpiece of Smallville, and sort of the brilliance of it, is something that existed in the 1950s.
Yep.
And Clark was directly responsible in the 1950s for Lex having lost his hair.
Yeah.
And it was the reason why Lex hated him in the comics, which
yes.
I thought was great. But it doesn't match with comic book continuity at all. And I remember when they were doing the pilot, that people were outraged and thought this will never work, and a young Lex has no business being with a young Clark, and what are you talking about, no flights, no tights? And, you know, 7 years later, it's part of canon.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, at its core, when it's done well, no one cares. And I think that when they originally came out with the idea that it was going to be Halle Berry, and Halle had been enjoying an enormous amount of success at the box office.
Sure.
It was a great idea. And the idea that Sharon Stone was the villain is a great idea.
Sure.
Is it a great film? Nope. Does it work? Nope. does anyone like it? Nope. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Right.
No one sets out to make a bad movie. You know, when you're in it, you believe in it, and you hope that it's going to work, and you think that people are going to come, and that it's going to be rocking up.
To wrap things up, I go back to another great Batman creator that sometimes gets neglected, and that is Steve Englehart. Man, I'll tell you, Steve is such a smart, good Batman creator, and I always thought did excellent work. I am disappointed that he doesn't get the due that I think he deserves. And it really does take, I think, older readers to kind of remember and say, you know, Steve Englehart really wrote some great stories, including the great Laughing Fish story of the 70s, which had a lot of plot points that wound up in both the Tim Burton movie and the Christopher Nolan movies as well. And I let Steve talk about that in this first portion of our conversation. My audio is a little rough. It's not horrible, but it's not top quality either, but you can hear me just fine. And Steve sounds excellent. His phone line was very clear. And again, he does the majority of the talking. But I think you'll enjoy this portion of my conversation with Steve Englehart, now on Word Balloon.
Joey Cavalieri, the editor at DC. I think DC wanted to do a number of Bat projects to sort of flank the movie release. And I guess Joey came up with the idea of putting us back together to do this thing.
Well, I like the fact that the tone of your Batman specifically has stayed the same, because certainly in this post-Frank Miller era, we've got a much grimmer, you know, angrier Batman that's a little more self-motivated, and it kind of loses some of Bruce Wayne, and we've got a very human Bruce Wayne story going along with the action in facing all these villains.
Well, I think that's essential. I mean, in any strip, I think the human side of it is important. That's me, and I mean, you know, I've always thought that I want to know who the person is who's wearing the costume, in addition to the cool part with the costume. And You know, the two things that I did when I took over the Batman in the first place was to really do the Bruce Wayne, really look at Bruce Wayne by way of Silver St. Cloud as his girlfriend, and then conversely, really do the Batman as much more of a pulp hero, a more dead of night under a full moon fighting a maniac in a rainstorm kind of thing than had been done before. And, you know, and that applied to the Joker as well. I mean, to make the Joker the more pulp murderer that he had been as opposed to the clown prince of comedy that he had become. So I kind of took it and made Batman more Batman and Bruce Wayne more Bruce Wayne. The interesting thing now is that, there were two, it's all sort of part and parcel, but your reaction has been a common reaction. A lot of people have written in to me and to DC and said, A, we really like what you're doing, and B, we really don't like, the other one, the one that the books are generally propounding. So DC has just switched editors on the books, and the new guy is gonna take it in our direction, basically. Bring back Bruce Wayne, bring back Commissioner Gordon, do more human interest stuff. So that, Frank Miller created a wonderful thing, but the specific thing about it was that was Batman at the end of his career, after he'd seen it all, done it all, and was reasonably burnt out. And the idea of trying to transfer that to the contemporaneous Batman, the ongoing Batman, mm-hmm. does not seem to have been a success,
Well, it's been an interesting 20-year experiment, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But and honestly, I like all forms of Batman. I think there's obviously as much validity to the Adam West Batman, the Dick Sprang, Jerry Robinson, Bob Kane Studio Batman, the Bill Finger Batman, your Batman, Frank's Batman, everybody. Denny O'Neill, of course, Greg Rucka. So it's, there's too many continuity hounds. And I'm glad to see that different interpretations of Batman beyond Elseworld stories, which, of course, you did your share of those as well, but that we're seeing a lot of different facets of Batman. And, yeah, I like this. And I like Dark Detective because, in a lot of ways, it's a Batman romance story.
Yeah, it is. Issue number 3, particularly, we were calling, between ourselves, the Batman romance book. And the first run was 8 issues long. And this one was only 6 issues long. The total page count's pretty much the same because the stories are longer now.
Okay.
But there is a difference when you've got 8 breakpoints as opposed to 6. Things have to move quicker, in a 6-issue thing. Even though you got the same number of page counts, you only have 6 climaxes as opposed to 8, and so on and so forth. And if I'd had, another couple of issues, I would have been able to stretch the romance. I would have been able to stretch everything a little bit more. Mm-hmm. As it happened, I specifically did not want to undo what I had done with Silver the first time. I didn't, it had to start off with them definitely broken up, but then I had to get them back together. I had to get them deeply in love, and then I had to work on from there and all that in 6 issues. So things, they moved at a faster pace this time. But by the 3rd issue, yeah, we were definitely, that was definitely the romance issue.
And you had experience, of course, back in the 70s and early in your career in doing some of the old romance comics of the 70s, am I correct?
Well, yeah, I just did a couple. When I was first breaking in, Marvel in those days published a lot of books, and in addition to all the, all the superhero stuff, they mm-hmm. still had westerns, and they still had romance, and they still, they were doing some horror books and
sure.
so forth. It was a place where new writers could, they could try you out. They could try you out on the sort of second and even third string stuff, where if you failed, nobody would particularly notice, but if you did okay, then you could work your way up, like AAA ball or whatever. And so I wrote a couple of romances. I drew a couple of romances. It was never a genre that I was deeply in love with, but I was happy to do it at the time in order to have something to do. And certainly, I mean, as I say, I wasn't particularly taken by romance books, but I do think that the human element is important in
sure.
everything that I do, and romance is certainly a part of, the human condition. So I'll generally end up with some sort of love situation somewhere in these superhero books.
And Silver St. Cloud, of course, is the one woman that got away. I mean, it seems like even, Vicki Vale, Julie Madison, you go back to you know, the 40s and stuff, there have been girlfriends, Kathy Kane, that have kind of come in and out of Batman's life. But, you know, Silver State Clown, for those eight issues, obviously made a huge impact on the audience.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. I mean, again, there had been, as I say, I went back to the original Batman, what you called the Bob Kane studio and Jerry Robinson and Bill Finger, those guys, to try to get a sense of the Batman. And he had Julie Madison, I guess, was his girlfriend then. But, I mean, girlfriends from then all the way through had basically been sort of arm candy. I mean, they'd show up long enough for Bruce to say, yeah, this is my girlfriend, therefore I'm a playboy. But nothing, you know, nothing ever really happened. There was never any depth to any of that. And I really, you know, I mean, I really thought if I was going to do Batman the way I wanted to do it, I wanted to know who this guy was inside the mask. And the best way to do that was to give him this kind of classic romance story. It sounds sort of odd. I mean, it's worked now, so, you know, it doesn't sound so odd. But one of the things that we were all debating as we did this, in somewhere along the line, actually in the sixth issue, but I'm not going to give anything away.
No problem.
About it. But Bruce has a chance to talk to Silver, but he's wearing the bat costume at the time, and I really wanted him to say something endearing to her, and I went through this whole thing. Can the Batman actually say the word honey? You know, it's like you can't really imagine Batman saying the word honey, and yet, you know, he is in love with her, and so on and so forth. But I eventually settled for just using her name. You know, I couldn't, the term of endearment coming out of the Batman's mouth never made any, it just didn't sound right.
You found the line.
Well, yeah, you know, but I mean, the point is that, so doing a romance with Batman isn't the first thing that comes to anybody's mind, but you do have to kind of find that line, because again, you know, he is the Batman. I mean, you can't just go, oh man, I'm going to turn him into a romantic hero and then forget, you know, all the other parts of him.
Mm-hmm.
That is the trick, yeah, to find that line.
And you're also able to point out that it is, you know, what Batman was that kind of drove Silver away in the first place, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, that gets back to pointing out exactly who he is. I mean, that's what I want. Who is this guy? Not what is his power, not what does his costume look like. Who is he? Because I'm, you know, I wanted to be an artist when I started out. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I tried to do. In the end, I decided that, you know, I could see it in my head, but I couldn't get it out of my hand the way I wanted, but I could get it out of my mouth the way I wanted, so I became a writer. I love comic book art. I love what it can do, and I love storytelling and all that kind of stuff, but I'm not an artist, so I'm going to be thinking more about the character rather than, you know, what he looks like.
I remember that they reprinted in the 80s the original eight-issue run as Shadow of the Batman.
Right.
And then it did come out in trade. Is the trade back in print again?
I don't know if it's in print. It seems to be readily available, so it probably is.
And I would imagine when they do trade Dark Detective, they'll bring back the original story, too.
That's what they've said, yeah, that they would bring them back as two. And in fact, since they do have pretty much the same page count, they'll look pretty nice sitting next to each other, you know, as Dark Detective 1 and Dark Detective 2. I consider the 70s run now as Dark Detective 1. I was talking about this with a retailer the other day who said, well, nobody will get that, you know, because it hasn't been called Dark Detective before, but hopefully when it comes out in trades, people will start to get that.
We always called it, I remember the Laughing Fish story, of course.
Yeah.
Tying it to what the Joker was doing. And again, as you did, you reach back to what the Joker originally was. You go back to that first Batman story where the Joker appears, and that is the Joker.
Yeah, that's the guy I wanted. And if you read the early, you know, like the first year of it, they did a nice thing where every story ended with the Joker usually dying, but sometimes going to jail. But in any event, the next Joker story would always begin with how he got out of that, you know, how he survived, how he broke jail. And I, in fact, again, I'm not going to give anything away, but when this series ends, I've got the Joker in a situation where I know how he would escape it if he, you know, if he was going to. I think if we do any more Batman, the Joker won't be in the next run, but I thought it was important to kind of touch base with that kind of stuff. They had a wonderful concept. I've been fortunate enough to meet Jerry Robinson. I met him in New York a month ago, and I was just in San Diego, and he was down there. And, mm-hmm. and he and I have, talked at both occasions. And, he said that after a while, they thought that in order to broaden the audience, they needed to kind of back off from the pulp stuff. And that's when they introduced Robin, and that's when they, made Batman a little less of a creature of the night and a little more of a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Which certainly I'm not going to second guess them, and secondly, because Batman has been a success, and so that's what they felt they wanted to do at the time. I'm able to go back and look at the stuff before that when it was more of a pulp character, and the Joker was a very fearsome villain, and so on and so forth. Jerry Robinson created the Joker, mm-hmm. And Robin, I should mention in passing. That was the stuff that I liked, and that was the stuff, again, since they moved away from it, nobody had ever gotten back to it. So, I just found that to be much more interesting to me, and apparently, it's interesting to other people too, but I liked that stuff from 1939 very much,
Sure. No, and again, that was the archetype, and that's what everything has been built upon, that foundation. Let me ask you about Marshall Rogers, obviously, whose art really, it's funny. Obviously, Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill came up with the new look of Batman in the 69 and into the 70s, and then Marshall came along with his version, and it was another innovation. And it's interesting because his art has changed again, obviously, in the 30 years since that first story.
Yeah, he says that, he was just learning to draw in those days. He and Terry Austin both were young guys who were just getting into the business. They'd done some stuff,
mm-hmm.
but this was their first major run. And they both, they were sort of deciding what they wanted to do as they did it. Obviously now 30 years have passed. They've all done plenty of other stuff. And Marshall now is very much into the bat costume. He talks about how when he drew it the first time, he was just trying to make it look cool, but now he's trying to think about how would it actually work,
Okay.
what would be. So if you look at it, the costume has undergone some modifications over time. I know Marshall feels that those fins on the bat gloves are not just decoration. They're kind of hard rubber things that you can hit people with, and
sure.
He's done a lot of thinking about this costume, which is, we're all into this thing, and it's nice to have people who are, to have everybody into it, not just, one or two, but everybody.
And you put the band back together for this project, which is great. Not only Marshall, obviously, but Terry Austin, too.
Yeah, well, when Joey called us, they called Englehart and Rogers, because that's,
sure.
People say, oh, it's the Englehart-Rogers book. Nobody usually mentions the inker. When they talk about stuff, but we did. As soon as they asked us, we said, well, of course, we want Terry to ink it. And there were a number of letterers on the first run, but John Workman had been the first one, and he had sort of designed in captions where the first letter is done in a circle. That's coming out of the early comics,
sure.
that approach, but he was holding up his end of it there by, being into it from the lettering standpoint. So we wanted to get Workman on there as well, and we were told that DC had pretty much given up on live letterers. They were all doing it on computer now, but we said we'd really like to get Workman, and so Joey went out and made that happen. I think he had to do a little horse trading, but, by the end of the day, we had everybody back, not the colorist. There was no particular colorist on the first one, so we got Chuckery this time. But at least the writer, penciler, inker, and letterer were the same guys.
Well, it's a beautiful production, and as you say, the sixth issue will be coming out Wednesday, and we're taping this obviously before its release, and I haven't read the sixth issue, but I've enjoyed the first five, and I do look forward to the final chapter. I should ask you before we move on from Batman what you've thought of the movie, if you've had a chance to see it.
I like the movie a lot. I'm not convinced. Me personally, I'm not convinced that that's Batman. I kept thinking this is a very Batman-like character,
What's missing?
It's not so much missing as I'm not, you know, the whole thing about deciding to study the criminal mind by becoming a criminal and then getting thrown into a Chinese jail where you can beat up large guys on a regular basis, that didn't strike me as anything that I'd ever heard of. I mean, it's not, see, that's the thing. It's not, you could believe it if somebody said that was the story. It doesn't negate anything.
Yes.
I mean, it fits in with the kind of character he became, but it's not, you know, I used to write Doctor Strange, and he went to Tibet, you know, but I'm not sure that Bruce Wayne ever went to Tibet or wherever this thing was. There was that kind of stuff that I kept thinking, this is, it's Batman-esque, but I'm not sure it's Batman. That said, it's extremely, you know, it's a very entertaining movie. It's very well made. It's very clever. A lot of stuff, you know, the script was very well written, and it was very well directed. I've got nothing bad to say about it. I just wasn't convinced that it was specifically the Batman.
Okay.
But I had, you know, again, I have my own take on it. So,
sure.
I wasn't sitting there going, well, if it's not my take, it's wrong. It's just, I didn't think it was a take.
It didn't connect with you. That's okay.
Right, yeah.
Sure. And we should mention, too, that for people who haven't read the first part, Dark Detective 1, elements of that ended up being adapted for the animated series.
Well, and for the first movie, the one Michael Keaton with Kim Basinger,
yes,
as, quote, Vicki Vale, I mean, she was clearly Silver St. Cloud in that movie. And I mean, I know the history of that thing, that they had tried from 1976 to 1986 to adapt that run. I mean, there's a number of scripts by people. It's all got Silver St. Cloud. It's all got Boss Thorne in it. Then when they filmed it, they decided that it had been so long since that book that they changed her name to Vicki Vale because it had been, 15 years or whatever, but 13 years. But the first movie is pretty much based on the run that we did. And then, yes, the animated series and everything all came out of that whole, you know, again, going back to the 40s,
yes,
approach that they had in the animation thing. And that, I think, you know, goes back to the early thing, that in the comics, somebody decided that they wanted to take Frank Miller's concept and apply it to the ongoing Batman. But for the world at large, you know, the movie and the animated series obviously was much more visible. And, you know, most people, I think, in the world at large who aren't big comic book fans still resonate to the, you know, to the one that Marshall and I did that then had its various permutations afterwards.
A couple years later, we had another conversation with Steve Englehart. This was after Batman The Dark Knight had come out, the second Christopher Nolan movie. And as we said in the first portion you heard, there were definitely plot points in the first Nolan movie. A lot more plot points in this second movie, especially when you look at the Dark Detective stories that Englehart did with Marshall Rogers before Marshall passed away. And you can't help but notice the similarities. And really, I urge you to make the comparison yourself. But I think we are pretty clear on how we describe a lot of the similarities to the Nolan movie and the comic book. And unfortunately, it wasn't a pleasant experience for Englehart. I'll let him talk about it now as we wrap things up on Word Balloon.
You know, it's funny you mention Dark Detective 3, and reading your email again, I was surprised, and I have to say it didn't occur to me watching the Dark Knight film how similar it was to a lot of the events in Dark Detective 2.
Right.
And to remind people, Rachel in Dark Knight is going over whether she should, you know, be with Bruce or be with Harvey Dent, who is district attorney, and there's, you know, a political edge going on. And in Dark Detective 2, Silver St. Cloud is going through a similar situation. Does she stay with Evan, the man that's running for office, or go back to her long-lost love, Bruce, who she's reconnected with and had to leave Gotham to forget? And, you know, I'll admit, I didn't realize that. I can appreciate as a writer you seeing that and going, hey, wait a minute, that looks way too familiar. Were you given a check for either Batman Begins or Dark Knight? I know a lot of other DC creators were.
Right. The answer to your question is no, I was not. And I am aware that other people did get checks. There's a couple things in there, I guess. One, I hadn't really noticed until I was putting together a little bit about it on my website that Harvey Dent in the movie looks exactly like Evan Gregory. You know, I even watching the movie, I hadn't necessarily internalized that, but when I came up with a picture of Aaron, whatever his name is.
Aaron Eckhart.
Yeah, he looks exactly the same. The same hairstyle, the same, you know, everything. The actual, so there were similarities. There were similarities. The other thing, but the actual thing was in Dark Detective 3 that never got published. There's a whole sequence in there in which Two-Face, in my story, Two-Face goes to Kevin, who is badly, you know, he's had his arm and his leg amputated in the previous thing. And there's a whole sequence in which Two-Face says, you really need to come over to the dark side. They're never going to accept you now that you're so damaged. In the Dark Knight movie, it's the Joker who goes to Harvey Dent and says, they're never going to accept you. You have to come over. That was lifted pretty much straight from the unpublished Dark Detective 3.
Wow.
DC has never wanted to, you know, to publicly admit where all this came from. You know, I mean, they went 20 years before asking Marshall and me and Terry to do another one. You know, for many of those years, I thought, well, this isn't good, but I, you know, it's a big corporation and what do I know? But at least, you know, with the first Batman movie, you know, there was plenty of press about the fact that it was based on my stuff. And
yes.
I got a paycheck later for working on the adaptation of my stuff.
I see.
I didn't get a gratuitous paycheck, shall we say. But this time around, they didn't even ask. I mean, they sort of deliberately, they didn't, not only didn't they ask, they didn't tell, you know. I didn't know about it till I got to the movie and saw my stuff on screen. So it was a pretty... You know, they don't want to be obligated to anybody, you know, for that stuff. And, you know, I'm not the only one who's had that happen to them in one form or another. I don't think Alan Moore is all that thrilled about a lot of stuff either. But, I became aware that other people actually got, other people whose stuff was not directly in those movies got paid. So, you know, whatever that's all about,
it's confusing. I mean, honestly, because really I was pleased to see that I think a lot of creators were compensated for both Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, because there were elements of previous stories that were pretty obvious that, oh, yeah, that came from Jeff Loeb. That came from Chuck Dixon. That came from, you know, name a Batman writer. And
Neil Adams told me he got paid.
There you go. Exactly. And so that's the surprising thing. The other thing, as you say, you know, the what you call the original Dark Detective and a lot of fans called the Laughing Fish story, the original Silver St. Cloud story, was such a popular story and was such a seminal story. As you say, it was – I know that for the longest time it was much more clearly in earlier treatments of the Tim Burton film, or what became the Tim Burton film maybe. I mean, it seems like your story was the one they kind of threw around. It was certainly in the Batman animated series. The whole Boss Thorne story was right there.
Right.
So, I mean, were you compensated for that?
Well, as I say, I got a check for working on the movie.
Okay.
But not as it turns out. I mean, this is I've never really opened up this can of worms. It's just something that I live with. But I found out later that by Writers Guild rules, the whole arrangement with me broke those rules, and I should have been paid a lot more than I was. But again, I was just a comic book guy. I didn't know. So they, you know, they were taking advantage of me from the start, basically. But yeah, every script for the Tim Burton Batman movie until the last one had Silver St. Cloud in it as the girl and Boss Thorne in it as the guy. And when it came time to film it, they changed the names to Vicki Vale and Boss whatever Grissom, I think.
Right.
And
Jack Palance's character. Okay.
And you know, and started down this road of sort of pretending that it just sort of fell out of the sky somehow, you know.
Crazy. Well, that sucks, and I feel for you, and like you say, it's a cautionary tale that a lot of other writers tell as well. Are you going to seek any type of recourse through court or anything? I mean, you know.
I think Steve Gerber with Howard the Duck and the people who have
Marv
gone
Wolfman.
Down that route have not gotten very far.
Yeah, Marv Wolfman with Blade. I know
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Although I think they eventually, you know, gave Marv a credit and some money. But, but I don't know. I don't say that for sure. I mean, I think that's true, but I wouldn't swear to that. But in any event, I don't, you know, suing Warner Brothers doesn't strike me as a profitable.
I understand. God, you know, I remember the story when Art Buchwald, the Washington writer, took Paramount Pictures to court over Coming to America.
Right.
Actually won.
Right.
And then when it came time for the settlement, the Paramount Pictures accountant said, gee, we made no money off of that movie that made $300 million, apparently.
Right. Absolutely.
So,
well, that's an old Hollywood story. I mean,
sure.
I, for all I know, they would claim that they made no money off Batman. I think that would be a little tough to do. But,
probably.
But, you know, as I say, it just – it is what it is. I mean, at the moment, basically, I just – I write – you know, I'm – walked away from comics, and I'm happy to be away from comics.
So there you go, some observations from other Batman creators, and I hope you enjoyed that. It was a pleasure bringing it to you today. Today's Word Balloon is brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. As always, thank you for your support via patreon.com/wordballoon. If you'd like to subscribe and don't do it now, that's the place to go to do it. I would really appreciate the help. Not asking for much. If you can spare a dollar a month, that would be fantastic. It would really help me out. And as I always like to say, Word Balloon is completely free, will always be free. But if you'd like to help contribute to the effort, go to patreon.com/wordballoon and subscribe. I would really appreciate it. Word Balloon is also brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Amazing deals are happening at InStockTrades.com. You can get the Thor Epic Collection trade paperback, God of Thunder, 50% off. It's just $17.49. How about the Amazing Spider-Man trade paperback, Volume 1, Parker Luck? It's post-Superior Spider-Man. Peter is back, and he is back being Spider-Man, and unfortunately, the Parker Luck is hurting him. It's Dan Slott and Umberto Ramos. The book is 50% off. It's just $8.99. From Mark Waid and Chris Somney, you can get Daredevil trade paperback volume 1, The Devil at Bay, 42% off, just $10.43. Satellite Sam from Matt Fraction and Howard Chaykin from Image. Volume 2 is 42% off. It's just $8.49. From Boom, Peanuts trade paperback volume 4, 50% off, $6.99. Just some of the examples of great savings that you can get at InStockTrades.com. Don't take my word for it. Go there yourself and start saving now. Don't forget, you get free shipping if your orders are $50 or more, and you'll find great savings all the time at InStockTrades.com. John Suntress saying thanks again for listening to today's Word Balloon. More great stuff is coming up throughout the month of October, into November, and into the holiday season. Can't wait to share with you some of the other conversations that are brewing and in the process of getting scheduled, and I will be bringing them to you, and I hope you enjoy them. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2014.